3 a.m. Tales of Terror contains explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, and welcome to 3 a.m. Tales of Terror. Maybe I should have moved my chair up, because...
Now you're fine. Okay. Fuck it, send it.
It's okay, I can be a little bit away from the mic, because I'm loud anyways.
No. No.
So on this episode, we are going to just be telling you some stories about famous hauntings or famous possessions, stuff like that. I'm sure most of you probably know. So I found... The main ones that people probably know about is the Perrin family and the Enfield Haunting, which is from the Conjuring movies.
The first one?
Yeah, I believe so. Then the... I did not look up how to say their last name. Snedeker from A Haunting in Connecticut.
Is it Snedeker?
Snedeker. Shut up.
The Snedekets from Connecticut?
And then there's Annalise Michelle, I believe is how you say her name, from, that is The Exorcism of Emily Rose, who that's based off of.
Yep.
But first, we're starting with the most popular one. And I want to preface that these are stories that Ed and Lorraine Warren did a lot of, but I know...
Which the Warrens are goated?
Yes. But they've also, there's also been a lot of... I don't know if you've seen it, but I've seen it about them being like schemers and they were just doing that for people and they're to get people's money.
Yeah. But the only problem with that is they're both recognized by the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
For what they do.
Yeah.
So going back to all the other times we talk about exorcism and all that stuff, for the Catholic Church to be like, yeah, we'll put our stamp on that.
Yeah.
I mean... So.
I mean, you can believe what you want. I mean, but this is not, I mentioned them a couple of times, but it's only because it's something that they did. And I think I actually only mentioned them in the first story about the,
Because I thought that they debunked a bunch of stuff during their investigations, too.
I don't remember. I don't know.
Because Ed was a handyman.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he found out that his wife was,
A medium?
Yeah, the veil. She could see the veil.
Yes.
He used his handyman skills to debunk, oh, it's just kids, or oh, it's a creaky house, or oh, it's this, or oh, your roof's leaking, you know, a tree branch went through it or whatever. So, I mean, if it's a scam, like, why would they debunk everything? If I was scamming somebody out of the money, I'd be like, I feel something in this house. Maybe like a drab.
I feel God in this Chili's tonight.
Yeah, Pam.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Okay. So, anyways, I was going to preface that. But we mentioned them. I really think I only mentioned them in the first story, but they might come up a few other times. So, but starting out, we're going to talk about the Perrin family home and the Enfield haunting. And I know that both of these stories take place in two different places, but they, when I Googled them, they were both together. Like they told this story together. So that's why I put them together.
What if it was the same demon?
I think that's what it was.
I mean,
I'm not sure.
If it was the same spirit, I could see why they would tell the story together then.
Yeah. I'm not sure, but I guess we're going to find out, because I really didn't read.
If you read,
I bet you'll probably find out.
Yeah, you'll probably find out.
Okay, so I'm going to start. Keek has joined us. He's not happy with us, by the way, because he had a vet visit.
The one day every year he has to leave the house for a total of like 45 minutes to go to the vet.
He got a rabies shot, so he's all set with that. And he's in his chair now, chilling. He's ready for us to read, just like you guys probably are. Okay. So anyways, the Perrin family home and Enfield haunting, this is from the Conjuring movie. This is what the Conjuring movie is based off of. So when the Conjuring was released in 2013...
Pause. It came out in 20... The first movie did not come out in 2013.
I don't know.
You're telling me I was 16.
Why don't you look it up?
When the Conjuring movie came out.
The first one? Probably.
No. It feels like it. Oh, God. I'm getting...
Probably.
Sure shit. I was 16?
I was 1 year out of high school.
We know Grandma.
I know.
I went and saw that in theaters.
I don't remember seeing... I think I saw Annabelle in theaters. I don't know.
That does not feel like it was 11 years ago.
Mm-hmm. It was met with critical acclaim. Critics everywhere praised it for its all-too-realistic portrayal of the demonic haunting of an innocent family in Rhode Island. Most viewers assumed that the movie was nothing but the wild imaginings of director James Wan. Bleh. However, the true story of The Conjuring is actually rooted in a horrifying true experience of Ed and Lorraine Warren. Ed Warren was a World War II veteran and a former police officer who became a self-professed demonologist after studying the subject on his own. His wife Lorraine claimed to be a clairvoyant and medium who was capable of communicating with demons that Ed discovered. In 1952, Ed and Lorraine Warren founded the New England Society for Psychic Research, the oldest ghost hunting group in New England. They quickly gained notoriety as respected paranormal investigators after their initial investigation of the Amityville hauntings. Their two most famous cases, however, were very heavily popularized by the Conjuring franchise, a series of movies that focuses on Ed and Lorraine's experiences exorcising demons from two possessed families. Though the movies seem over-dramatized and impossible to believe, the Warrens maintain that all of the events depicted actually transpired. Though Ed died in 2006, Lorraine was a consultant on the film and claims that she didn't let the directors take any more dramatic license than was necessary.
Yeah, because there's an Easter egg.
What?
That she's in the first Conjuring movie. She's in the audience.
Oh, yeah.
When they're doing their big speech and they pan the camera, she's in the front.
Oh, mm-hmm. I don't remember. The first Conjuring movie?
That's my favorite.
We have them all, though. We should watch them.
Yeah.
I think we have them all.
I don't think we have the nuns.
Well, the nun is on... It's on... The nuns are on, like, Paramount or something like that.
Nevertheless, the true story of The Conjuring remains almost unbelievably chilling to this day. The true story of The Conjuring begins when the first film, which focuses on the Perrin family. In January 1971, the Perrin family moved into a 14-room farmhouse in Harrisville, Rhode Island, where Carolyn, Roger, and their five daughters began to notice strange things happening almost immediately after they moved in. It started small. Carolyn would notice that the broom went missing or seemed to move from place to place on its own. She would hear the sound of something scraping against the kettle in the kitchen when no one was in there. She'd find small piles of dirt in the center of a newly cleaned kitchen floor, which is super bad omen, by the way. The girls began to notice spirits around the house, though for the most part they were harmless. There were a few, however, that were angry. Carolyn allegedly researched the history of the house and discovered that it had been in the same family for 8 generations, and that many of them had died under mysterious or horrible circumstances. Several of the children had drowned in a nearby creek, one was murdered, and a few of them hung themselves. Hanged doesn't sound right.
But I think that's how you're supposed to say it, because...
Yeah, because I hung the clothes up.
Mm-hmm. But a person is hanged.
Hits the ear wrong.
I know, but that's...
And a few of them hanged themselves in the attic. The spirit that was depicted in the film, Bathsheba, was the worst of them all. Should I say it twice more without...
I don't think that's how that works. With the spirit.
I don't know. Bathsheba's the woman demon, right?
Yeah.
Quote, "Whoever the spirit was, she perceived herself to be a mistress of the house, and she resented the competition my mother posed for that position," end quote. Said Andrea Perrin, the oldest of the five girls.
Yeah. I know it's weird, but a person is hanged, and you can hang a picture frame on the wall, but it's the past.
I mean, I can hang a person on a wall, too. I hung the body in the attic.
No, you hanged it.
It just hits the ear wrong.
I mean, I know that, but that's what it is. I don't know what you want from me.
Solutions.
Okay. I don't have those. It turns out there was actually a real person named Bathsheba Sherman who lived on the parents' property in the mid-1800s. She was rumored to have been a Satanist, and there was evidence that she had been involved in the death of a neighbor's child, though no trial ever took place. She was buried in a nearby Baptist cemetery downtown Harrisville. The parents believe that it was Bathsheba's spirit that was tormenting them. According to Andrea, the family experienced other spirits as well that smelled like rotting flesh and would cause beds to rise off the floor. She claims her father would enter the basement and feel cold, stinking presence behind him. They often stayed away from the dirt-floored cellar, but the heating equipment would often fail mysteriously, causing Roger to venture down. Over the 10 years that the family lived in the house, the Warrens made multiple trips to investigate. 10 years is a long time to deal with all that shit.
Well, I think in the movie, when they talk about it, mm-hmm. I think that something had happened where they had to move out there.
Oh, yeah.
In like the rickety old farmhouse.
Yeah,
and they got like a good deal on it. And I think that they were... I think in the movie they talk about it more where like the husband lost his job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the mom worked. I'm not sure.
I don't know.
But then plus on top of that, you have 5 kids.
Yeah.
Now granted, I mean, what year was it again? 71.
Yeah.
So, I mean, cost of living probably wasn't too bad, but you still got to make a living. Because
mm-hmm.
I think that's why the husband kept leaving the house is because he's like, I'm going to go look for a job. So... it makes sense on why they lived there for 10 years and just kind of dealt with it because they probably couldn't do anything else.
Yeah. At one point, Lorraine conducted a seance to attempt to contact the spirits that were possessing the family. During the seance, Carolyn Perrin became possessed, speaking in tongues and rising from the ground in her chair. Andrea claims to have secretly witnessed the seance. I thought I was going to pass out, Andrea said. My mother began to speak a language not of this world in a voice not her own. Her chair levitated, and she was thrown across the room. Though the movie versions of events culminates with Ed performing an exorcism rather than a seance, Lorraine insists that she and her husband would never attempt one, as they must be performed by Catholic priests. After the seance, Roger kicked the Warrens out, worried about his wife's mental stability. According to Andrea, the family continued to live in the house due to financial instability until they were able to move in 1980. Shut up, stop looking at me like that.
If you would just read, you'd find out.
At which point the spirits were silenced and the hauntings ceased.
I only remember that because it's a movie that I'm interested in, and my autism hyperfocuses on movies, so I know like all the little details.
Your autism hyperfocuses on a lot.
I have a lot of interests. 6 years after the Perrin family was terrorized by their demon, another family in Enfield, England began to experience similar things. In August of 1977, the Hodgson.
I think it's Hodgson.
Hodgson?
Yeah.
Fair enough. In August of 1977, the Hodgson. I want to say Hodgkin for some reason.
But there's no K. Just Hodgson. Hodgson.
The Hodgson.
There you go.
Family started seeing and hearing strange things. Janet, who was 11 at the time, recalled sitting up in bed to see her dresser slide across the room that she shared with her brother. Quote, "We shouted, 'Mom, Mom,' said Janet. We were sort of frightened but also intrigued." Same. White people.
Oh my god.
That's white people shit.
I mean,
Dresser slid across the floor. Mom! Hold on. What's gonna happen next? We should go investigate. Let's split up. That's white people shit.
Yeah.
As white people, I can say that.
Like in the scary movie when we were watching that Watch Mojo, she's like, okay, you white people always say split up. And then the dude in the wheelchair, he's like, okay, you three come with me.
No. She said, what was it?
We have to stick together.
In every scary movie, all y'all white people always stick together when we split up and it's all the white people and y'all leave the rest of us. He's like, no, we don't do that. All right, let's split up. You three come with me. And then all the white people left. Again. Later, the family began to hear knocking coming from all sorts of places in the house. She remembers her mom thinking there were burglars or drifters hiding out in their home and calling the police to investigate. The officer who arrived reported witnessing a chair rise up and move across the floor on its own. Reporters from the Daily Mirror, which is a sketchy name for, like, a newspaper.
Yeah. Daily Mirror.
Maybe because the movie Mirrors messed me up as a kid.
That movie was not scary.
Yeah, when your sister makes you watch it at, like, 8?
I mean, that's what happened to me with The Grudge. That's what...
Vicky made me watch that movie. I think I was like 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. And mom had, I don't know if she had it when we were dating, but in, you know, you go down the stairs.
Yes.
And the right side.
Yes.
Where she put that wainscoting.
Yes.
There used to be a mirror like the size of that window there. So then naturally, Vicky would mess with me because I was a scaredy cat before I was, I don't know, probably 12 or 13. And she'd stare at it and go, "Do you see the person in that mirror?" Just to fuck with me.
Wow.
Yeah. And then when I got older, I started doing it to her.
Yeah, Miranda.
So the tables turned.
Miranda wanted to watch The Grudge with me. And I was like...
She's not that much older than you, is she?
She's only like 3 years older than me. But it was when we first... My parents weren't married yet, I don't think. So... I was probably 11 or 12, which made her...
So this was back in like the 70s.
It was like, they got married in 2006, so...
I'm just making fun of you for being old.
So that means she was probably like 14 or 15, and she wanted to watch it. And I don't remember the part where I jumped, but I jumped. We were laying on the floor, like in sleeping bags next to each other, watching it on the TV. And I jumped. So, and I did like this with my arms, and I fucking knocked her glasses. And she was like, "Dude." It's like, "Well, you're making me watch a scary movie."
Legos and marbles were reportedly flying around the room, hot to the touch when picked up. Clothing folded on tabletops would leap off of them and fly across the room. The sound of dogs barking would be heard in empty rooms. Lights would flicker. Coins would drop out of thin air, and furniture would spin or tip over when being touched. Then, one day, the iron fireplace in an upstairs bedroom was ripped out of the wall. After that, paranormal investigators from all around the world showed up, claiming to be able to contact spirits, and wanting to know more about the Enfield haunting.
I mean, the only thing that is, like, okay about that was the coins falling. I would love coins to just fall from the... like a gremlin. Just go and grab them. Can't be that lucky.
There's a movie about that.
What?
It's a demon that would entice people. No. It's Spirited Away.
Oh.
No Face.
Yes.
Would entice people with gold nuggets. He would make gold nuggets appear from nothing.
Oh. Like the fairy at the Renaissance Festival.
Yeah, except for the fairy didn't eat people.
Oh.
Because that's what he would do. He'd get you close, make you comfortable with the gold, and then when you got close, he'd eat you.
Oh, I don't remember. I only watched that movie once with you.
Yeah, it's a masterpiece.
I'm not a big, what is that? Who was it? Don't tell me. Studio Ghibli.
There you go.
I'm not like a big fan of that, but I've also never been a big fan of anime in general, so.
You're a fan of American anime because you watched cartoons as a kid.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, anime is just the Japanese word for cartoon.
Well... Yeah. Okay, so I'm not a fan of Japanese anime. Like, I
mean, that's racist.
I just don't like it. I don't know why.
Spirited Away is a masterpiece. I'm trying to get you to watch Kiki Delivery Service.
I've it's seen all about Kiki's cats. Delivery Service.
Did you watch Howl's Moving Castle?
No.
My Neighbor Totoro?
No.
Masterpieces.
Okay. We can maybe. I don't know.
Probably not.
Most of them decided that the children had been faking their experiences, as one of them had admitted to doing so on one occasion, but the Warrens were different. They showed up and immediately believed that a demonic presence was present. However, their claims were overlooked, as a noted skeptic at the time accused Ed Warren of exaggerating and even making up incidents, often transforming a haunting into a case of demonic possession. This is where the story differs from the movies, as there was no exorcism-like practice from the Warrens. In 1979, 2 years after they began, the hauntings abruptly stopped, though the family maintains they did nothing to stop them.
I don't know if ghosts just move on.
I mean, I guess they can.
If it's a demon, if it was a demon, sure shit, not moving on. Mm-mm. Probably not a demon, though. Probably a ghost.
Well, they said that, you know, a lot of people died in that house, so maybe they did. They finished their business. Get it? Unfinished business. That's why ghosts hang around.
What?
So anyways, that's the story of the Perrin and Enfield family hauntings. I think a lot of a few of these stories I did get from the same website, but I'm just going to, at the end of each story, I'll just tell you what my resources, because I just put it at the end like that. So, right. I got the Conjuring and Perrin family. I got the Perrin family and Enfield haunting story from All That's Interesting. So, did you have anything else you want to say about that family or that ghost? I remember Bathsheba from the movie, because they were in that basement and the mom was like, she like yelled her name in the movie. The mom of the family yelled Bathsheba.
No.
Yeah.
Nope.
In one of them.
Nope. It was Lorraine.
Oh, it was Lorraine?
In the second one when they're in England.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
With the kids, because, I don't know, in the movie, that's the demon that was, like, going over and over and over again, and she'd torture families and then leave, and torture families and then leave. Mm. Oh, and they didn't figure out her name in the first one. She just went away.
Oh.
But when they're in England, that's when she finds out
her name.
Yes, and that's when she gets thrown out of the window.
Right. That's okay, I remember that now.
Because she sees her face and starts yelling Bathsheba, which, you know, if you know the real name of a demon,
you have power over it.
You have power over it.
Yes. Okay, so the next story is about the Snedeker. That's how I'm going to say that, because I don't know how else to say it.
It tracks.
Snedeker family haunting, which is the haunting in Connecticut. That's based off the true story that movie is based off of. So,
the movie with Ryan Reynolds in it?
I don't know.
Haunting in Connecticut.
Haunting in Connecticut was the one with the ectoplasm. I remember that.
And the TV.
I think so. I don't know.
With the little boy.
TV with a little boy?
Or am I thinking of Apocalypto?
I don't know. A TV with a little, I don't know, Poltergeist is a TV and a little girl. Carol Ann, come to the light.
You know what? I think where it's all fuzzy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I'm thinking of.
There's also The Ring with Fuzzy and a girl.
No. I'm talking about the little boy, like, wide-eyed, just trance in front of, like, a fuzzy TV with the white noise.
That sounds like, is that The Sixth Sense? No, it's that. Oh, God. I know what movie it is. Dark Skies with aliens.
Nope.
Okay. I don't know then. But Poltergeist is a little girl, not a boy.
It is not The Haunting in Connecticut.
The Haunting in Connecticut's with the ectoplasm.
Yeah, where it comes out of the kid.
Mm-hmm. The teenager, I think it was.
Yeah.
When they're doing the...
What am I thinking of?
I don't fucking know. I've named off every movie that I can think of that describes what you're talking about.
Poltergeist.
Okay.
It was Poltergeist.
But Poltergeist is a little girl.
Okay, that's fine.
So,
but yeah, that's okay. What I was thinking of, where it's like the fuzzy white noise that would happen when cable would turn off.
And then Poltergeist is in there saying, Carol Ann, come to the light.
Yeah, and then hands on TV and then
sucked in. Okay, yes. So their hands on the TV? Yep, yes. That's Poltergeist.
So it was Poltergeist.
Okay. If you would have said hands on the TV, that's Poltergeist. Okay, so anyways, we're not talking about that.
I see that. We're talking about a haunting in Connecticut.
Yes. In 1986, the Snedeker family moved into their new home in Southington. I think that's how you say that.
It's spelled Southington.
Connecticut. But 2 years later, the family would leave the house, telling stories of shocking paranormal activity. The true story of the haunting in Connecticut begins in 1986, when the Snedeker family moved into the historic home at 208 Meridian. Meridian Avenue. The Snedekers were desperately searching for a home to rent in the area so their son Philip could receive treatment for his Hodgkin's lymphoma. I remember that a lot from the movie, because he was very sick, and that's why it latched onto him.
Yeah, because he's weak.
Mm-hmm. At a nearby Yukon hospital. The house on Meriden Avenue seemed like a perfect fit, and the Snedekers rushed to move in. They did that because it was cheap, it was affordable, and it was close to the hospital. That's why they moved in. So
that checks out.
What seemed like a lucky find quickly turned into a nightmare once the family began experiencing paranormal activity. They reported seeing and hearing unknown forces, being attacked in their sleep, and even experiencing violent personality changes. So this is the true story that inspired a terrifying Hollywood horror film.
I think I'd burn the house down if I was being attacked in my sleep, collect the insurance money, and then walk away.
Literally. But yeah, I remember that's why they moved into that house, because it was stupid cheap. They could afford it and also afford his hospital bills, which the hospital was like very close. It was only like 10 or 15 minutes away from that house. So that's why they bought it.
That makes sense. The beginning.
Dramatic pause.
Fucking Robert. The Snedeker family were like any other middle-class American family. They were Carmen Reed, her husband Alan Snedeker, and their four children, Philip Bradley, Alan Jr., and Jennifer. Philip Bradley Morris? A family company. Anyway. Carmen's niece, Tammy, also lived with the family. At a young age, Philip was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, a type of cancer that affects the body's lymphatic system. Because of Philip's diagnosis, the Snedeker family often had to travel long distances from their home to the Yukon Hospital for treatment. Eventually, the family felt that it would be better to move closer to the hospital so that Philip would not have to suffer through long and other painful car rides.
Often.
Whatever. The search began for a home large enough to house the Snedeker family, and soon they found what they were looking for at 208 Meriden Avenue. The 5-bedroom, 2-bath house provided plenty of space for the family, and so on June 30th, 1986, the Snedekers signed a lease and moved into the house. See, this is another reason why I did not want to buy another house. Because all the sketchy shit that happened in Kayville.
You're the only one that saw sketchy shit in Kernersville.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing that I ever noticed...
I was the only one that was awake.
Well, the only thing that I ever noticed was the fucking attic door kept... The attic kept getting moved over, so it looked like somebody would go up in there and be in the attic and put the lid back on, and it looked like it had been opened. That's all I ever noticed, but nobody was living in the attic, though I don't know because I never went up there. Just like I'll never go in this attic.
Why?
I don't go in attics. I don't know.
Because you can't fit or roasted.
No, I don't like them. I'm not like...
Well, if I die traumatically, there's a lot of shit in this attic. You better get it out.
No, that's what yo mama is for.
You're going to make my 64? My old ass mom?
Yeah, and mine. I'm getting in the fucking attic. She can stay up there. I don't know. I don't like attics. I can do basements. I don't do attics.
That logic is poor.
I'll get up there and I'll start shaking. Like, I don't like them.
It's just another room.
I don't know. There's something about them. I don't like it.
Right.
The disturbing history of the Southington home. The move-in process seemed seamless for the Snedekers. The children picked their bedrooms with minimal arguments, and the family loaded their belongings into the house smoothly. Everything seemed normal until Carmen, I almost called her Carbon, Carmen made a disturbing discovery in the home's basement. Laying among dusty boxes and old furniture were funerary items. The family claimed that the basement had been, embalming equipment and other materials necessary to run a mortuary. According to a 2002 documentary about the case, A Haunting in Connecticut, Carmen stated that she had no idea that the home had once been a funeral parlor. When she toured the home, Carmen said that she was unable to enter the basement because the renovators had blocked the doorway with materials. I'd be like, dang, that's fucking crazy. I'll come back when I can get in the basement. Because if I was her and I had known that it was a funeral parlor, I would not have moved into that house. I don't give a shit.
Well, I mean, in New England, a lot of houses that are old like that were probably used as some type of hospital.
I know, whatever. Oh.
I'm not buying a house that I can't get into every room.
And that's what I'm saying. I would have come back and been like, okay, you can let me know when I can come back.
Like, you see people all the time that are like, yeah, we found this hidden door in our basement.
God, why didn't you find it when you fucking toured the house?
I would have found that hidden room when I was touring the house. Oh, there's a red door? It kind of smells
just like
blood.
That house in Rural Hall. You know? Like, the one that smelled moldy. Because it was like concrete
Hummingbird
floor.
Hollow.
Mm-hmm. It was on Hummingbird Hollow.
Yeah, I found the secret door for the office.
Mm-hmm.
For the bookshelf.
A room that was musty as fuck in the middle of it.
It's because water was pouring. That's why as soon as we walked in and then I saw the right side of the house, I was like, this has water problems.
Yeah. Carmen confirmed that the house was once a funeral home by contacting Daryl Kern, the home's owner. Kern stated that the property was once the Hallahan Funeral Home and had been in operation for decades, though he claimed that he told the family about this before they moved in, as per a 1992 piece in the Hartford Courant. This disturbing fact did not prevent Carmen's sons, Philip and Bradley, from claiming the basement as their own bedroom. As the oldest Snedeker children, Philip and Bradley wanted a private space for their own, and the basement was spacious compared to the smaller rooms on the upper floors.
Valid. I feel like that's a guy's thing to want to move into a basement.
Yeah. Philip and Bradley reportedly slept in the casket display room down the hall from the embalming room. In addition to mortuary equipment, the Snedekers also found images of the deceased on the property. According to Chasing the Frog, Carmen Snedeker said, there were a couple of photos in the home, but there were many toe tags and a head tag. There were other personal items of the deceased. I remember the pictures in the movie because they found them in like a box or something.
I mean, the trick to that is you just get rid of all of it.
Yeah.
And then you bless and cleanse the house.
Well... okay, they barely had money for his hospital bills. You don't think they had money for a freaking priest?
You don't pay a priest to cleanse your house. They just do it.
Oh. Well.
You have to be part of a church.
Oh.
I'm noticing a trend here.
What?
Most of these people aren't church-going people.
They normally aren't.
Of any religion. Part of a religion. I'm not saying Christianity, which, yeah, cool if you are. Sweet. But... most of these, like, horror stories in America are these people are like, yeah, we're just not religious. Well, no wonder shit's happening to you.
Yeah.
Just be some type of religious person. Spirit. Be a spiritualist of some type.
Mm-hmm.
To help.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't pay a priest. Like, I didn't pay Earl to do our wedding.
Oh, true.
He did it. One, he's a friend, but he's also a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I tipped him for doing it because, hey, he came out and, you know, cool, whatever. Mm-hmm. Great. That's what you do. But you don't pay him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you don't pay for, like, a cleansing. You don't pay for exorcisms or anything like that. It's the church looking after their flock is how they look at it.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's how Catholics do it. I don't know. I haven't delved too deeply into, like, Islam.
Yeah, I don't know.
Stuff like that. I know more of the Catholic Christianity side of things.
Right.
But I'm sure every religion has it.
Yeah.
Because to have good, you got to have evil.
Well, most of the time if you're dealing with like poltergeists and demons and spirits and stuff like that, you're going to go towards Catholic.
No, not necessarily.
In America, you probably would.
Well, that's just because America was founded by white Anglo-Saxon Protestants.
Yeah.
That's literally what they were called.
Oh.
Those are your racists.
Oh.
Yeah. So anyway, now we're going to talk about the Snedeker's family, their terrifying experiences with the paranormal activities. The most horrifying aspect of the true story of the Haunting of Connecticut dealt with intense and often violent interactions the family said they had with the paranormal. The paranormal activity in the home started the night the family moved into the home, and it targeted Philip more than any other family member. Quote, my son started seeing this young man with long black hair down all the way to his hips, Carmen said, stated to People magazine. He would talk to my son every day. Sometimes he would threaten him. Other times he would stand there and just say his name, which is enough to scare him. However, the spooky happening slowly spread to other family members and escalated in intensity. Carmen claimed that while mopping the floor, the water turned into blood and gave off an acrid smell reminiscent of rotting flesh. You probably just didn't clean the mop head. The mop water was a blood red. I mean, a deep, deep red. It made my skin crawl. I started getting nervous that I was ruining the floor, Carmen said in the 2002 documentary.
You got nervous that you were ruining the floor and not the fact that water turned to blood? Get with it, people.
My floors. Most shocking was the claim from both Carmen and Alan that unknown forces had raped and sodomized them.
Well, they left that shit out of the movies, because I don't remember that.
Yeah, I don't think you can show on the big screen a grown man being raped by a ghost. Well, sodomized, because a man can't be raped.
Yeah.
Sodomized. And then a woman also being forced is bad taste. I don't think anybody wants to watch that.
No.
Like, because just the idea of it makes my skin crawl.
Mm-hmm.
And then having, like, if I was watching a movie and that happened, I'd be like, ugh.
Yeah.
While unknown forces physically tormented the adults in the family, they seemed to take a deeper interest in Philip than ever before. The Snedekers started to worry when Philip's personality began to change. He became irritable and reckless, often inflicting cruel punishments on his younger siblings. On one occasion, Philip placed Bradley on a gurney and spun him around until the younger boy begged him to stop. He also locked his brother in a closet and walked away.
That was in the movie. I remember that. Because I was like, if my fucking brother did that shit to me, he'd be next. He'd be on the list to be next.
I never had that problem.
What?
My sister would never overpower me.
I mean, I know.
And then you've seen the doors of my mother's house. It wouldn't hold me for very long.
Yeah. The worst incident came after Philip attacked his cousin Tammy and was consequently forced to spend 45 days in a hospital. Doctors eventually diagnosed Philip with schizophrenia after he told them about the entities he saw regularly, but they noted that the medication he was on to treat his cancer could not have given him hallucinations or triggered any dormant schizophrenic illness. The Snedeker family decided it was best to send Philip to live with relatives, and reportedly Philip stopped hearing voices and seeing spirits after this. With such strong indications of paranormal activity, the Snedeker family contacted Ed and Lorraine Warren, two paranormal investigators, as well as a priest, to do an exorcism on the house. On September 6, 1988, a priest performed an exorcism on the house, and the family reported that the paranormal activity suddenly disappeared. Later that year, they moved out of the house and never returned, thus marking an end to the supposed true story of the haunting in Connecticut.
I mean, he could just be lashing out, too, because he's dying of cancer.
Yeah.
And he's fucking angry. He's a teenager.
Yeah. So...
now we're going to talk about if it's a hoax or not.
Yeah.
Hoaxy pokesy. Dramatic pause. With Snedeker's fantastical claims of violent paranormal experiences, some people doubted their validity. The Snedeker family went public with their experiences prior to leaving the residence, and Daryl Kern noted in 1992 from the Hartford Courant that the reported paranormal activity seemed to escalate when the family was behind on the rent. That's valid. It's a scheme to make money, Kern said. Even the family's neighbor, Catherine Altimus, believed that the whole thing was a hoax. I think they had this plan right from when they moved in, she said in the same newspaper piece. The neighbor noted that the family always appeared jovial whenever they were outside, not acting like a terrified family. Friends of Philip even stated that they didn't believe the story given his personality. He was a storyteller. He always had to be the center of attention, Jeffrey Pooler said to the Hartford Courant.
Well,
see, on one hand, I get that, but on the other hand, if you look at, what was the one we read the book? The name?
Amityville.
If you look at Amityville, they only were messed up when they were in the house.
Mm-hmm.
When they were outside, going to the bar, day trip, stuff like that, they were good because the house was the bad.
Yeah.
So it's like, on one hand, I get it. On the other hand, I also get it. But if they needed to make money with the paranormal stuff, why wouldn't they make it super extravagant and then make sure stuff was happening when people could see it?
It's true.
Because, like, if I wanted to sell to our neighbor, that this house was haunted. You know, it's not. We fucking built it. I would make sure that when she comes out, I would do stuff in front of windows. Lights flickering super late at night when I know that they're outside.
Mm-hmm.
To force it to be like, yeah, I'm going to get the neighbors in on this too.
Yeah.
It's a really hard story to sell if literally your next door neighbor is like, nah, I didn't see nothing.
Right. 2 weeks prior to the Hollywood film's release in 2009, more people spoke out against the family's claims. I can't believe that movie came out in 2009.
Yeah.
Oh, still a long time ago, too.
I knew that was an older one, at least.
Including a new owner of the supposed haunted house. We've lived in the house for 10 years. Our house is wonderful. Suzanne Trotta Smith, the owner of the house in 2009, told NBC Connecticut. This is all Hollywood foolishness. The stories are all ludicrous. While people debate whether the story behind one of Hollywood's most spine-tingling horror films is true or not, the true story of a haunting in Connecticut and the Snedeker family has certainly solidified itself as one of the greatest ghost stories in American history. That's also all from allthat'sinteresting.com. But, I don't know. I mean, I get both sides of it too, so.
Yeah, it's 50-50.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it goes back to Amityville, though, too. Because, like, the neighbor said they didn't hear anything, but, like...
Yeah, they didn't hear... What was it, a 22?
No. No, it was a 30-06.
That's what it was. Which is louder.
Because I don't know if the podcast picked it up or not. Because I got my lever action, that's a 30-06. No, mine's a 30-30.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit smaller. Well, a little bit bigger. But I was like, so you're telling me... He shot him with a lever action rifle and racked it, and you didn't hear this. I did it as slow as I could, and you could still hear it clink and clack.
Yeah.
And that's a newer one, so an older rifle would be even louder.
Yeah. Because that happened in the 80s?
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Yeah,
I think so. So probably a Winchester or a Marlin.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So.
But they also don't really talk about a lot of stuff, because it was changing their personalities and messing with them only while they were sleeping. It wasn't like destroying the house.
Right.
Chasing them out of the house. It wanted them to be in the house so it could feed off of them, which is probably why it was only doing, if it was a demon or a spirit or whatever. It's probably why it wasn't doing anything super like dramatic,
because
it wanted them to stay so it could feed.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
I also tried to find, like, the Sally House, but there's not shit that I can find about it, because the Sally House is kind of like the Haunting in Connecticut, sort of. It was a doctor lived in that house, and this little girl was dying. She had appendicitis, and she, like, was well past needing to be in an emergency room, so they took her to the house. He performed an appendectomy, and she died, and so now she haunts the house, but that's all I can find.
Well,
so
short little story for y'all.
Yeah. So, okay, so I really like this story about Annalise Michelle, The Exorcism of Emily Rose. That's one of my favorite possession movies to watch, and...
I don't know if I've seen it.
Stop. Really?
I don't think so.
I think you have. Because I don't know. We'll have to watch it if you haven't. Because it's so good. Okay. So, but there's a lot that happened to her. So, you know, that they had to leave out of the movies. This, probably more than anything, I'd probably believe this story. I don't know how much, you know, they might exaggerate. I don't know. But. We're going to find out. Okay. So, I guess it's Michael.
Legitimately, have never seen that.
What?
Nope.
Oh my god, we need to. Okay, I think it's actually Annalise Michael. I think that's how you say their last name. Okay.
Hold on, we have Google Translate.
Well, they're also German, so that's probably right. Or, yeah, German.
Just German, it'd be Mikkel then.
Well, we're going to say Michael for our sake.
Stand by.
So, maybe it is Michelle.
That's in English.
Well, German? See, Scared to Death did a story about her as well, and that's how he pronounced it. I'm not pronouncing it like that. I'm not pronouncing it like that.
I told you, it'd be Mikkel.
So, German. Okay, so I'll just say we'll just say Michelle. Or Michel. I think that's what it is. Michel.
Yeah, and if it was a C-K-E-L, it'd be Russian, which is Mikhail.
Yeah. Okay, so it's Annalise Michel. The Michels, a deeply religious family, lived in Klingenberg, a small town in Bavaria, West Germany. The father, a sawmill operator named Joseph, had once considered becoming a priest, and there were no less than three nuns in the extended family. In 1948, Annalise's mother, Anna, gave birth to an illegitimate daughter, Martha. This was so disgraceful that when Anna and Joseph were married, Anna was forced to wear a black veil during the ceremony. From that point on, Anna insisted that she and her family atone for the sins and the sins of others. This was the world that Annalise was born into in 1952. Growing up, Annalise was, like the others, encouraged to be overtly devout as a form of penance for the sins of the family that predated her. Mass was twice a week, and the girl's time was largely spent indoors praying in lieu of playing with other children.
Sundays and Wednesdays, by the way.
When Martha died at the age of 8, it added additional pressure for the young Annalise to be that much more repentant, even made to sleep on a stone floor to atone for the sins of the drug addicts at the train station. The punishment at the hand of her zealot parents resulted in Annalise, a well-liked student with a penchant for languages, developing neurosis triggered by religious icons. It didn't help matters that Annalise was a sickly child, having had measles, mumps, and scarlet fever at a young age, leading to additional physical and psychological ailments that plagued her into her teens.
And I'm sure the church told her that the reason why that was happening is because of the sins of her family.
But I'm surprised she survived scarlet fever, honestly, because a lot of people did not. At the age of 16, Annalise blacked out at school, with friends reporting that she was in a trance-like state for a minute or two. Later that evening, Annalise woke up from her sleep saying that she had a heavy feeling on her body and had wet the bed. A similar incident the following year brought Annalise to a local doctor. As reported by the Sun, neither the doctor nor the neurologist found anything wrong with her, but tuberculosis would send her to the hospital in February 1970. I did not realize that she was that sick as a kid, and that's fucking crazy.
That she got TB in the 70s?
Yeah. That she had the measles and the mumps and scarlet fever and then tuberculosis, and that much stuff to her lungs like that? I'm really surprised she lived.
During the hospital stay, Annalise confessed to seeing colors, hearing sounds, and experiencing euphoria while saying a rosary. But the strange experience didn't seem to warrant any deeper investigation. She was, however, diagnosed with grand mal epilepsy due to intermittent convulsions. Soon the experiences Annalise had while saying the rosary to evil hallucinations, followed by severe depression and thoughts of suicide, encouraged by voices in her head telling her she was damned, and that was just the beginning. Yeah, she probably had traumatic fucking depression and anxiety from the church condemning her for the sins of her parents. Well, yeah. No, because she had the illegitimate child.
And I mean, I get kids getting sick, but I feel like what she got sick with is a whole other level. Especially back in the 70s.
No, the 50s.
Yeah,
she didn't get TB till the 70s, till she was older.
Yeah.
According to the Telegraph, Annalise would be performing 600 genuflections in a day.
I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that is either.
I saw that and I didn't know what it was. I'll look it up. To touch the knee to the floor or ground, especially in worship.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So you genuflect before the altar.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't. Maybe it's a German thing. Like.
No. I mean, I've never used that. I've never seen that word used for it.
Right.
But getting on your knees and praying. But
600 in a day?
She's probably begging for release.
My God.
Leading to the damage to her knee ligaments. She then barked like a dog for 2 days straight while hiding under a table. Annalise reportedly lapped her own urine off the floor, ate spiders, coal, and a dead bird's head, and screamed for hours on end. Her family wanted to bring Annalise in for further medical tests, but she insisted on an exorcism, and after two failed requests, a third was authorized by Bishop Josef Stangl. Father Arnold Renz was appointed by the bishop to perform the exorcism, aided by Father Ernst Alt. While the first rite taking place on September 24th, 1975, the exorcisms, most of which were recorded, revealed numerous demons in Annalise seeking control. Lucifer, Cain, Adolf Hitler, Judas Iscariot, which is Judas's last name, Nero, and others. The exorcisms continued with one-hour-long sessions held secretly in the bathroom of her parents' house, where Annalise was often in need of restraint, either by holding her down or chaining her to a chair. Well, it'd be really hard to be possessed by Adolf Hitler when he wasn't dead. So, that'd be kind of difficult.
Well, in 1975, they thought that he was.
In 1946. Four.
Yeah.
It was 4, 5, or 6. I can't remember. In the early 40s, everybody thought Adolf Hitler was dead.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the early 2000s that they found all the complexes in like Brazil and Argentina that are still to this day armed guarded and have Nazi red crimson flags all over them.
Mm-hmm.
Because he didn't die.
Well.
Because the United States government.
I'm sure he's dead by now.
Well, yeah. But he didn't kill himself.
No.
The United States government captured his ass and used him to help fuel our nuclear program against the Russians. It's true.
The recordings during these sessions are, as the Telegraph describes them, a terrifying listen. Obscenities are screamed. A series of throaty gurgles mixed with inhuman growling can be heard, as well as the demons each poetically lamenting.
Lamenting.
The horrors of hell.
They're describing it. Mm. They're basking in it.
11 months before passing away, Annalise stopped taking her medication by order of the priest, who were wholeheartedly convinced that what was plaguing Annalise was spiritual, not medical. That was probably their first mistake. Because I don't know if I would have made her stop taking her medicine.
Well, if the priest thought the medication was making her weaker and then an easier target, yeah. I understand.
Yeah. Her body started deteriorating from malnourishment and dehydration. Barely recognizable, Annalise became covered with bruises and bed sores. Her hair began falling out, her teeth were fractured, and she had wasted away to a mere 68 pounds.
Hot damn.
My God.
It's like my left leg.
I know. Finally, after nearly 70 exorcism sessions, Annalise passed away on July 1st, 1976. According to the Sun, the battle for Annalise's soul was won, with the priest claiming to have seen... the priest claiming to have seen stigmata marks...
Stigmata.
Mark said to represent where Jesus was nailed to the cross on her hands and feet, taken as a sign she had been freed.
Oh, okay, so when she died, she received the stigmata of Christ, which is the whole, it's scars. Yeah. It's scars in your hands, and then
on so they believe that she was free of the demons.
Yeah, I mean, at least it worked.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why she died, because the vessel was so consumed.
Yeah.
Especially if it's like a legion of demons.
Yeah.
Not great.
Yeah, no.
The two priests and both of Annalise's parents were charged with negligent homicide, with the trial beginning on March 30th, 1978. The recordings were played for the three-judge panel, and along with Annalise's own insistence on being possessed, became key points for their defense. The prosecution, on the other hand, testified that Annalise's death could be attributed to epilepsy, mental disorders, and her extremely religious upbringing, which Professor Hans Sotz of Würzburg University chalked up to a spiritual sickness and heavy psychic disturbance, according to the Washington Post. It was faith versus fact, and ultimately fact won out. The four were found guilty, but were given lenience, sentenced only to time served, and 3 months probation. The trial spurred German bishops to petition Rome in 1984, asking for a review of the exorcism rite. The recommendations made by the bishops were not adopted at the time, but in 1999, the Telegraph notes that the Vatican did publish a revised exorcism rite, the first since the 17th century. So that's when the church pretty much stopped wholeheartedly doing exorcisms.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it'd be like that.
Yeah.
It also introduced a revision where in order for priests to become exorcists, they must undergo medical training. Although never stated publicly, it would seem to speak directly to Annalise's case, the one positive to have arisen out of her anguish. Which, I mean, yeah, I mean, I agree.
Yeah.
Times change. You kind of, on a religious aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
No, they should be able to do what it is that they do, but on the other aspect of it, which I understand, is if you're dealing with somebody's mental well-being, being possessed or not, you should have psychological training, like psychology, and then you should also have medical training to see if you're slowly killing them on accident.
Yeah. Okay. Despite this, Annalise, even in death, couldn't escape from the extremely stifling religious autocracy that filled her life. Her parents buried her next to Martha at the outer edges of the cemetery, where illegitimate children and souls lost to suicide are relegated.
Honestly, shocked they buried people.
Yeah.
That killed themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. After a nun told the parents that she had a vision that Annalise's body was still intact, proof of her possession, they exhumed the body in February 1978. It wasn't. The body had decayed naturally. Even as recently as a 2013 interview in the Telegraph, Anna still insists that the exorcism was the right course of action, despite her daughter's tragic death, as she, too, claims to have seen the same marks as the priest did. I know that we did the right thing because I saw the sign of Christ in her hands. She was bearing stigmata, and that was a sign from God that we should exorcise the demons. She died to save other lost souls, to atone for their sins. I'm assuming that's a quote from her mom.
Yeah.
So, the exorcism of Emily Rose does take some artistic liberties, including Americanizing the story of Annalise. What did I say? Michelle. But does retain the faith against fact story that made the original trial so fascinating. As for whether Annalise was actually possessed or not, it's a question that may never truly be answered. But the deeper you read into her tragic story, the more it becomes evidence that sometimes fact backs up faith.
Yep.
And I got that story from Collider.com.
We should watch the movie now. I'm interested.
I was going to read another story, but we'll just save it for another episode because I'm sure I can find some more possessions and hauntings and stuff like that that it can go with. But yeah, I mean, we can watch The Exorcism of Emily Rose. It's so good.
I mean, you could always stack it up with Pazuzu here in North Carolina. We haven't done a story on him yet.
I know. I'm trying to find stuff about him too, but it's hard.
There's a whole documentary. Well, actually, it got taken down. The sheriffs sued Netflix for it.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it made the sheriff's office look bad. No, because, like, people didn't understand that when people were calling and complaining about the smells coming from his house, that you have to have probable cause, and you can't just walk in there. A judge is not going to give you a search warrant for a person's house saying that it smells funny. That's not how that works. So it made the sheriff's office look bad on one hand, because, like, after knowing what happened, you're like, dang, they should have done stuff differently. But on the other hand, due to, like, I don't know, law and human rights and the Constitution, cops just can't barge into a dude's house because your neighbor says it's smelly.
Yeah. I mean, you can't barge in, but what they could have done was a wellness check.
On who? Nobody was reported missing.
It doesn't matter. Now, I don't know about back then, well, but agree, now but you can do a check. Wellness check.
Yeah, you knock on the door. Okay, cool. Sir, can I come in your house? No. That's it.
But if they opened the door, they would have been able to smell.
But the body wasn't in the house. He buried the bodies in the backyard.
Still, they would have been able... If they didn't have... All they had to do was do a wellness check.
They did. That's the thing. They went to his house, I think it was 5 or 6 times. And other than the fact that it was a sloshed, gross party house... Because I watched the documentary before they took it down. It was so good.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they did everything legally that they could. The only time that they got the warrant to search the house was when the girlfriend snitched.
Yeah.
And the only reason why the girlfriend snitched is because she thought that her psycho boyfriend, who is I can't say a serial killer because I think he only killed 3 people.
And not in different places.
She thought he was going to kill her. So she went to the police and was like, I will tell you all of this if you give me immunity. And they said, no. we can cut your sentence back for helping us out, but we're not giving you immunity. And no. She still ratted.
Yeah.
So you can add it with that.
Well, maybe I can find something on him and we can put her, the LaToya Ammons.
Because he claims to be possessed by demons too.
He's also dead now, so.
That's because he killed himself when he went to prison.
Well.
He tried to kill himself at the jail too. But, yeah, so that's the podcast.
Yeah, so, I guess other than that, we will see you later. Don't forget, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at 3AM Tales of Terror. You can reach out to us both of those ways, as well as emailing us at info@3amtalesofterror.com. Questions, comments, concerns, anything you want to talk to us about, story ideas, email us, reach out to us one of those 3 ways. And other than that, we'll see you next time. Also, sorry for skipping last week, but we got busy and I forgot about it. So, anyways, or the week before, whatever. So, anyways, we'll see you next time. Bye.
Later.